Hello, Agnes.
Okay, I want to tell you a story. It's a really old story. It's one of the oldest stories that there is. It's about this guy who, someone insinuated that his father wasn't really his father and his mother wasn't really his mother. And so he went to an oracle, and the oracle said, "You're going to kill your father and marry your mother." And he's like, "Oh, no." And so he rushes off, and he's like, "I'm never going to go to where my parents are again. And I'm going to go somewhere else." And at a crossroads, he meets a man, and they get into a fight, and he kills the man. And then he continues on to Thebes, and there he solves the riddle of the Sphinx, and then he marries the queen, whose husband has recently died. And, this guy's name is Oedipus. And the thing that happened to Oedipus is that he did exactly the opposite of the thing that he wanted to do. That is, his whole goal was to not kill his father and marry his mother. And the actions, and they were really pretty significant actions, like running away from home, that he took to achieve that result, achieved the opposite result of what he wanted. So he is, his behavior is counterproductive. And I think that the reason why the story of Oedipus is compelling is that feature of it. That is, that, you know, there's one way to understand the word tragedy, where tragedy is where something sad happens to you, like your arm gets chopped off or something. And it's like, that's really sad. Or like your friend dies. Those are all sad things, but they can be really sad. But the really tragic thing is that Oedipus did it to himself. He was the agent of his own destruction. And I think that Sophocles tells this story because he thinks human beings are characteristically the agents of their own destruction. We characteristically act in counterproductive ways. And I'm just generally interested in this phenomenon, in the ways in which when we try to control ourselves and we try to control other people, we reliably induce the opposite result.
So I think most rationalists will initially be skeptical of your claim.
Yeah.
So we should try to win them over.
Yeah.
So first you could say, well, surely we will often have error with respect to our initial goals. There'll be a range of outcomes relative to our goals. And sometimes the error will be, so far as to have a counter effect than our intention. But you might say, well, that's just because there's a wide range of error. It's still true that on average, when you try to go in one direction, you go there, but noise gets in the way. So that might be the first counter argument to say, convince me it's not, you're not just looking at a tail of a distribution where it happens to be worse. Convince me there's an actual tendency to undermine your own actions. That would seem to be the skeptical response. And so I do think we can come back with some responses, but we need some more compelling, more common examples, I think, to convince people that there is this counter tendency, at least in some identifiable cases.
Yeah, I mean, one, just to approach that from a funny angle, the rationalist community have, on the whole, it seems to me, disproportionately become overtaken with the fear of the robot takeover, right? And and you might think that's not very rational, like you think it's not very rational, right? But they're using rationality to get to this result, right? They're like reasoning about it, and the reasoning is throwing them into a panic. And according to you, and I'm kind of inclined to trust you on this, that's actually not a rational response, right? So that would just be an example. That's one thing I might say to a rationalist is, look, it's happening to you. It's happening to you right now.
Right. I meant rationalists actually in the just much wider sense of, people who think they try to control their lives and do so, as opposed to the more specific rationalist community.
Just meant it as everyone. I mean, everyone.
Right. Right. But there is this ironic effect that apparently the recent big advances in AI were produced by this company, this organization called OpenAI, run by this guy, Sam Altman. And he has given credit to sort of the major criticism of his advance of AI, Eliyahu Yudkowsky, and say, you inspired us to jump ahead. But that's more of a concrete example of a counter effect. But you still might think that was just an unlucky draw. So can we find more systematic cases where, you know, when we try to do something, it goes the other way?
Right. So I think resisting temptations is a good example.
Don't think about pink elephants would be a famous concrete example.
Right. It's just that in a way it's not that concrete because who cares whether you think about pink elephants, but actual real life examples are like don't eat the cookie, where quite often your attempts to... I had a friend who...
Don't stare at her chest.
I had a friend who would, like, he was really loved dessert, but he was always on a diet. And, like, he would do things like he would, like, buy these treats, but then he didn't want to eat them. And so then he would, like, lock them in the trunk of his car, figuring that he wouldn't, like, get out of the house at night. But he would then just go out of his house at night and, like, go to the trunk of his car. So he's, like, trying to outwit himself, right? Trying, in some sense, to control himself. But the self he was trying to control was resisting. And I think that that's sort of the key to the idea that I'm interested in, is that the thing that we're acting on is often resisting our effort.
Right. So let's just go through some more concrete examples. So a parent might encourage their kid to go to bed, and then their kid might be all the more resistant to go to bed, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you might have a spouse and there's something way you want them to reform in some way, and you push or nag them, and they see you're pushing or nagging them, and then they become resistant and try all the harder to exert their independence and do the opposite, right? And that might happen with many other people who feel rivalrous to us. We for their own good want to push them in one direction, but they see our pushing it and resent it.
Right. Another example that I find very, like, striking is, like, the free speech wars, where the people who believe in free speech sort of, and culture wars in general, they want to, like, fly under the banner of free speech, and they're sort of stomping and yelling about that, and then that organizes the opposition in a way against them, and now all of a sudden there's an enemy that's kind of against free speech, partly because you're like, you know, this is our team. So actually pretty often just fighting or standing up for something is enough to, like, organize an opposition that might not have unified itself as an opposition to that thing were you not to present yourself as being, if you create a side, you also create the other side.
There's a trope of, I guess, police or detective movies where the person who's trying to have you not suspect them acts in a distinctively different way that flags them as, this person doesn't want you to suspect them, really bad.
Right.
Because they don't know how they usually act, and they go, oh, I need to act normal in order to not let them suspect me. They don't really know what normal looks like, so they pick this very simple, stereotypic version of normal, which, you know, makes them really stand out. I mean, the same might be true for, say, a guy who really likes a woman in a group of people. Like, he's trying to act really nonchalant and act just like he doesn't care about her, but he might completely fail at that, right?
A perfect concept where this always happens is being cool. Like, you can't try to be cool. If it seems like you want to be cool, it's not cool, right? And so trying to be cool is, like, always going to be counterproductive in this way. It's always going to be edible, I might say.
So we have these two cases we want to distinguish. There's when somebody else reacts to your, attempt to manipulate or control them, and they do the counter thing. And then where you do it to yourself, which we might think is more puzzling. So that's why I was trying to start first with the examples where other people react to our attempts to influence them.
Right. Then, cool is an example of that.
Right.
Other people reacting. Yeah. But I actually think there's three cases. That is, there's you reacting to yourself, and maybe that's the most paradoxical. That's like my friend and the locking the candy bars in the trunk. There is one-on-one interactions, like a parent and a child, or a spouse, or a date, or and then there's group group situations. Cools might be a group situation, but also like culture wars, you know, where by standing on one side, you organize the other side. Where that's not a one-on-one. It's importantly, group phenomenon. So that seems to me yet a third context for this, and a very important context for this kind of counterproductive behavior. Yeah. There's three.
Right. Especially when, like, if some group says they're going to try to help you, and many people get very suspicious, or when, you know, especially many people are resistant to the idea that they need help, right? So there's a common sort of theme in welfare economics or welfare policy that people who you might help don't want the stigma of your help and will actively resist the label that you're trying to put them on them, that you're the person who needs help.
Right.
So in our individual lives, we have the cases of it's hard to make yourself have fun.
Yeah.
It's hard to make yourself fall in love or out of love.
Really. Oh, yeah.
And it's often hard to sort of make yourself follow a plan of things you're supposed to do, like exercise or work hard at your career or study as you're supposed to. Often, diet, right? And often these things, you know, we find that our behavior does the opposite. The more we tell ourselves we must focus on our task, the more we find ourselves distracted and doing something else.
Right.
But the more we tell ourselves we must eat well, the more tasty that dessert looks. The more we obsess about it and think about the dessert we might get, right?
Right. And like, so here's like what I'm inclined to say. In a way, I'm inclined to think that it's helpful to start with the big group case, the third case, in that, like I sometimes have this feeling of, I don't know, somebody will make a claim. It might even be a claim I agree with, but they put themselves out as like the warrior for, I don't know, great books or something. Everyone has to read great books.
Right.
Like, I kind of agree, right? But now that you're going to be on team great books, I'm going to be on the other team. And the point there is, the opposition there was the creation of the original move, that is the move to forward great books, created me as the opposition. And I wonder how much that applies to the other cases, and it could even apply to the self case, right? Not that you have some second self in you that sits there that is really likes tasty food or something. That could also be true, but it's just that by saying to yourself, this is who you're going to be, that induces the rebellious response of like, no, I'm not.
So certainly in groups of people, we can see more objectively a process. Somebody stands up and says, I and my allies are better, and we deserve our prominence and status because of this thing about us. And then you immediately want to go, I want to take you down. How can I take you down? And I think, okay, you're going to attach yourself to this thing. Well, I'm going to knock down this thing you're attached to. Then, right? And you can see how just a status envy or rebellion, like somebody put themselves up and you don't want them to be up. You want to be as high as them or higher, and you're just going to be oppositional and take down whatever they're trying to put up.
I'm not sure that the concept of status is prior to the thing they were trying to explain. So I'm reluctant to say.
Okay. But we can actually see that as a concrete motivation in this group case.
In the group case, yes. But my point is that it exists in the other cases too, and it's very implausible to think you have status envy with relation to yourself. But you know, something that we observed when talking about this topic before, is that you and I have a lot of control issues when we talk to each other, right?
Right.
And so, like, it's somehow trying to control something creates resistance to that control. Not necessarily if the thing is inanimate, right? I mean,
right.
Even in that case, but typically if the thing is inanimate, it wouldn't create these issues. But if the thing is animate, and it could even be yourself that's animate, that somehow trying to control that kind of thing, we don't reckon on the fact that the thing that we're trying to control also has a mind or something like that. And then the fact that we're going to kind of create this kind of parallel organization. And it strikes me as very similar to like the mistake I make when I play chess and I forget that the other person is also thinking about the moves that I'm making and the future moves that I'm going to make. I find it very hard to remember that. Like, I plan several moves in advance and I don't think about the fact that the other person knows I'm doing that and is predicting my moves and all of that. Like, I just, in the abstract I know, but in the concrete I forget it. And that's typically why I lose.
So I think we're agreeing that we're seeing this deep-seated, very robust behavior pattern where we resist attempts to control us. We resist processes that seem to be trying to control us. And it came to mind when you talk about inanimate objects. I often, have the situation where some inanimate object is supposed to behave a certain way, and then it just keeps not doing that. And like, I'm stuck and I just can't make it do the thing. And then at some point I want to retaliate. I just want to like slap it or something, like to say, how dare you defy my, and try to control me in this way. I might be stuck on something. I can't get it unstuck or whatever. Right. And so you can just see right there, this like building resentment against this thing, this inanimate object that appears to be trying to control me because I can't escape its clutches. I mean, obviously it's not intentionally doing that, but I'm so habituated to this that I will treat it that way.
Though it seems to me that the right way to describe that situation is that it is resisting your attempts to control it, right? And it's interesting that you describe that as it's trying to control me.
So I think that's common with, say, symmetric conflicts. Each person will focus on framing it as the other person trying to control me and my attempts to control them. So we read this book, Independent People, a while back, right? And we had this main character, the Artur, who was really focused on other people not controlling him. And
right. He
was really controlling the rest of his family, but that completely escaped his notice. And anytime there was a conflict between other members of his own family that he was controlling, he framed it as, how dare you try to control me?
Right. So, but I think that it's only half the story to say we resist attempts to control us. The other half is that when we try to control other people, we don't predict that they're going to do that. That's weird, right? Because we know that we resist. And so then, like, we're trying to control someone, and then we're surprised that they turn into the opposition. So it's the not factoring that in.
I think it might be a pretense there. That is, I think what we're more fundamentally doing is allowing ourselves to be indignant at their resisting in some way. And therefore, we can frame that as, I'm so surprised that this would resist in this way. I'm so legitimately the one who should be controlling this. Surely they would have accepted that. And if they are resisting it, I'm just surprised and indignant. That is, if I were too obviously expecting it, I couldn't be so indignant about it.
I mean, I just think that to a large degree, we really are clueless. Like the chess thing brings that out. That is, it's really easy for me to forget that my opponent is plotting against me. And I don't think I'm just pretending there, because I want to win. I'd like to beat them. And if I could just make myself remember that all the time, then I would do better.
I think we frame this often as we have a sense of legitimate control. Who should control what? And we...
I think I should be winning the chess game.
Well, that is... And we... If other people will go along with our concept of legitimate control, we think that's generally pro-social. This would be, it's just a best way to do it, and that would just be better for everybody. And if everybody would go along with the obvious way to control things, then we would just all be better off. And then there's this conflicts, which are anti-pro-social, that is, they hurt us all on average. And I am not in favor of conflict, I'm just in favor of having the right person be in control, who's the obvious person, but then I'm just tend to presume that it's me. I'm biased in my presumption about who should be in control in any one situation, and then I get to be morally indignant that this other person is you know, conflicting with me for control, and they should recognize that I'm just a legitimate person who should be in control here, and therefore they are causing conflict and causing overall harm by their resisting my legitimate rule.
I mean, I think that in some way, controlling is just living in the sense that you're just making the decisions to make your life work, right? And so maybe
some of those choices affect other people. Some of those choices limit other people's options. Some of those people's choices require other people to do particular things to make them work. And that's how they start to see us as controlling them.
Right.
But from our point of view, it's just, well, somebody had to be in control here, and this would be the obvious thing to do, and I'm just doing it.
But, okay, I mean, what is about, it seems to me that the in some way the core case of this phenomenon is the way it relates to that yourself also tries to resist your control.
Yes.
And fights back. Ourselves fight back all the time. You know, it's hard to even understand what it is to be an agent if you can't act out what you think is the right way to go without unraveling your own plans constantly.
Right, so the surprising thing is to realize that inside ourselves there's at least two parts. One part that decides to plan and control itself and, you know, makes choices not just for the immediate moment itself, but makes choices for a larger overall plan of your life, and it does that with some sense that it's justified in being in that position and legitimate and should be able to make such choices, and is only has our best interests at heart and is doing a reasonable job of it. And then there's this other part of it that just says, fuck you, who the hell are you to make these choices? I didn't ask for that. I want to do these other things and I defy your control. There's another part of ourselves that's that way.
But it strikes me that the two parts are not independent of the activity of controlling. That is, it could well be that the part of me that wants to overeat, like, you know, my husband says, I'm going to the store, what should I get? And I say, get a chocolate babka, which I know that I love, and if I get it, I will eat that later. Whereas if I, there's other desserts that I could tell him to get where I know that I won't eat them because I don't like them as much, right?
Right.
So the, you know, the part of me that loves sweets there is like taking it in hand, right? To plan for the future. Under other circumstances, it could be the part of me that's like, don't eat too much chocolate babka is like, you know, says I won't go into the kitchen after a certain time so that I know that I won't eat it, right? So it could be either my love of chocolate babka or my reasonable restraint is going to be the controlling self. They can either one be the controlling self.
Right.
And it almost seems like the other self, the annoyed recalcitrant self, is like a product of the controlling self.
Same thing also happens in these other relationships between other people. That is, somebody's apparent attempt to tell you what to do and to run your life is what makes you resist them. And often somebody resisting is what makes you try to control them.
Mm.
That is, they reinforce each other. The surprising thing is that it happens within us, not just between us. I think we have more of an intuition why. If somebody were just to be a bit arrogant and defiant and troublesome, you might want to, you know, shut them down and control them a bit and, like, make sure that they aren't out of control. And somebody trying to shut you down and control you might make you resist and defy them all the more. Those make sense between people more intuitively, but to realize it happens within you is, I think, the big surprise.
I mean, I think it's pretty surprising that it happens between people, because if you think about it, right, the person who's being a bit arrogant and trying to shut you down, what they're trying to do is sort of dominate you, but they're going to make you way more difficult to dominate, because now all of a sudden you want to fight against them. And so now what do? You're like, oh, no, I'm you know, I'm going to stand up for myself. And now they're going to get way more attempting to be domineering, that it's you're going to sort of reliably elicit from them the opposite reaction of the one that you want. And like, you might say that's tragic. There's something tragic about the fact that, like, in trying to control or dominate you, I'm making you less controllable and less dominable.
So there's something a bit puzzling here, that I think that there are many cases where an attempt to dominate succeeds.
Yeah.
That we aren't, you know, that proud of noticing that we are often succumbed to that. But in fact, like movies and TV shows and stuff, they often like celebrate the defiant person. But in fact, quite often if somebody is challenged with a dominance move, they submit to the dominance. They just back down and shut up and do what they're told. That's really quite common.
Yeah.
So when you make a move of dominance, you could induce them to submit and back down, or you could induce them to rebel. I think it's not obvious in general which way that'll go, but I think we like to tell ourselves that we wouldn't submit. We would always rebel. And if the cost seems low, we will, if we can get away with it. But I mean, we're neglecting the cases that, in fact, you know, people quite commonly just react to an aggressive dominance move with submission.
Right. Good. So maybe it is in Dalmoy's counterproductive. And it might be that it isn't always counterproductive with respect to yourself either. Maybe sometimes you just get yourself meh.
Right, but there's a sense in which you need a pretty strong response to get the submission. It can't be, you know, milquetoast and mild. Generally,
right.
The cases that seem to me the most clear are where you have a really strong response, and then, you know, people back down. But, of course, you know, if you submit to some very strong response, you will probably resent it. And you will then later on be looking for a chance to retaliate.
Right.
So in the long run, they'll be less effective than in the short run.
Right. Right. And so they're going to need to then harm them, protect themselves from you, the aggressor, right? Because they're going to know that. And so now they need to, like, set up a structure that makes it impossible for you to take the revenge that you're looking to take, and not to organize with others in your position.
Right.
You know, they might succeed in the short run, but yeah, like in the long run, tyrants would routinely get overthrown. Because people organize against them.
Right. Or more precisely, they weren't called tyrants until they were overthrown.
I mean, in like the ancient world, they were.
Right, but I mean, in the ancient world, my understanding is we have a king, they have tyrants. But it's basically, whether someone's called a tyrant depends on whether you're, you know, whether they're yours or somebody else.
No, that's not true. The in the ancient world, a king was somebody who was, like, say, had hereditary access to the monarchy, but a tyrant was somebody who became the ruler from the outside. So Oedipus, who's the king of Thebes, is called Tyrannos. He's a tyrant. He's not tyrannical. Everyone loved him.
Right.
You know, he was accepted as a legitimate ruler, but he was a tyrant because... irony, right? Irony marker. He had nothing to do with the royal family. He was a total stranger. So that's like what tyrant meant. It's someone who comes from, and often somebody who comes from outside is going to be achieve power tyrannically, as we would say. But, that's why Oedipus could be called tyrant without being perceived as being tyrannical.
So I have this story of, you know, forager to farmer to industrial personality, saying that foragers were very resistant to domination. They had extreme priority placed on egalitarian relationships. And then that farmers were more willing to accept ranking and domination, kings and slaves and war and things like that. And then in the last few centuries, as we've gotten rich, we've moved back a lot toward more of a forager style, at least outside of work, and that explains a trend toward egalitarian habits and styles. And so that in my mind suggests, you know, what we're talking about is sort of an egalitarian response.
Yeah.
a sense that, you know, you're something's trying to put itself up above me, and I'm going to, you know, prevent that, and I feel morally justified and in you know, even required to do such defiance. That's a very forger sort of style. And so we might wonder how much people had the self-defiance problem 1,000 years ago.
Right. So that's really interesting, because it suggests that different social norms are going to conduce to different degrees of counterproductive behavior, right? And so, like, if we have a really clear hierarchy within a group, then people can control one another without inducing the aggressive response, because they'll just accept the dominant.
Right.
But if we all think that we're equals, that equality is very fragile, right? And so there's constantly this question of, are we getting out of equal anything that I do? Like, and so, like, you and I, right? So this would show why we're, like, we get in control battles, is that we're in a relation of equality, and that every time one of us talks, the other one's not talking, right? So there's always a bit of an imbalance. And so equality is going to be an equal world is going to be a tragic world. It's going to be a world with lots and lots of counterproductive behavior.
So this might be just me, but we've talked in the past, I believe, about motivation as a deep mystery, and sort of almost, I've said, like, the closest thing to magic in our world. It's powerful. It's hard to see where it comes from. And, you know, various words evoke it or things. So motivation is really powerful and important. And it seems to me that I notice that this urge to resist, to defy control, is an extremely powerful motivation. It's one of our strongest sources of motivation. And we often use it that way. That is, many people have, like, been spurred to, in their career, because they thought somebody thought they couldn't do it and they were going to prove they could.
Right.
Right. And even in yourselves, often, like, this urge to, like, defy this control, it could just really produce this strong, powerful motivation that puts energy behind doing something.
Yeah. Good. It's basically something like revenge.
It's a defiance. It's a, like, a
defiance.
You know, how dare you try to do this to me? I'll show you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's powerful. It's really powerful. And in some sense, it's more powerful than the, I want to shut you down, I want to be in charge. I mean, that's kind of powerful, but it's not, it doesn't have as much energy, I feel like. It doesn't have the raw, just oomph of,
yeah.
Oh, no.
Right, right. I mean, in a way, Oedipus is like, hell no, I'm not doing what you're saying, Oracle, right? The question is, how reliably counterproductive is this motive, right? And you think it's going to reliably be pretty, like, pretty counterproductive, because, you know, if it involves, like, trying to control the other person, then...
So, but let's consider so-called reverse psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, I mean, you might find one way to motivate people is to elicit this defiance from them.
Right.
And so you might pretend to oppose them in some way, pretend to control them exactly to induce this responsive effort. So
I think parents do this all the time in so many different small ways. Most of them are not, they're not very conscious. Once you're conscious of it, it's too unsophisticated to trick your kids, but it's the less conscious way. Like, for instance, where you'll just pose things to your kid, like, oh, you probably don't want to do this or something, you know, and, like,
right,
probably not interested, whatever. And they're like, yeah, I am, you know. I feel like something like 15% of my interactions with my kids are, especially my youngest, who's very defiant. So I think that's totally right. And I've noticed, I mean, there's stuff that he incredibly hates that he will totally do if he has this kind of motivation. You know, he'll walk a really long distance in the freezing cold without complaining if somebody thought he couldn't do it or something like that.
Right.
But I wanted to go back to the relation to ourselves, to the question of maybe in other historical periods, people would have had fewer of these battles. And I think that's really true. So I think that it's sort of like canonical in the ancient world that there are higher and lower parts of yourself. And then even later, you know, even up through the Enlightenment, there's this idea of reason and passion or something. And the thought there is like there's a hierarchy in your soul. Plato, it's very clear. He has like a three-tiered hierarchy. And there's like the part that's supposed to be in charge. And then there's like the middle part that's supposed to listen to the top part. And then there's the bottom part that you got to like keep it in order. And so like top part is reason. The middle part is like your passions, like anger. And then the bottom part is like your appetite. And, you know, if you really just accepted this hierarchy, then maybe your appetites would just accept being dominated. But I think we very much live in a world where all of ourselves want to be free and equal.
Right.
And so it may well be that we are more acratic and more given to these complicated battles with ourselves than people would have been at a time when they didn't reconcile themselves to those hierarchies.
So it occurs to me that the prototypical 60s hippie radical expressed a defiance of the authorities of the day in part by defying the self-control within themselves. That is, they explicitly said the previous authorities, they're too self-controlled. They're stuck, you know, they are not free internally. And so a strategy for resisting authority is to resist the parts of yourselves that so far have been in alliance with authority, and to say, you know, release yourself, you know, feel free, do follow your emotions, follow your passion, discover all these things that the authorities have repressed in you. And that's an interesting alliance between these two kinds of rebellion.
Yet in the Gorgias, Socrates says, obviously, moderation is one of the virtues, right, Callicles? And Callicles is like, no, I don't accept that. I don't accept. So moderation is like restricting your bodily appetites, your desires for food and sex and things like that. And so Callicles is like, I don't accept that as a virtue. I think the virtue is like indulging them to the extreme. And he connects this with, this is why you need to become rich and you need to like, and have power over other people so that you can satisfy these giant appetites that you're going to grow. So he directly connects the self-indulgence with the unwillingness to accept political domination, because Calcus's point is like only suckers follow the rules and behave themselves. A real man is somebody who figures out how to be on top.
There's also an obvious connection, now that I notice it, with classic seduction strategies. That is, you know, you have a young person who's been very self-controlled, and then the pitch is, you are too self-controlled, right? You're missing out on all these other experiences you could have if only you would let go of all this excess self-control. And then the claim is, that's just the authorities, your parents say, trying to control you. And then the seducer will say, if you would only resist your parents' control, you would be more free and enjoy yourselves by, you know, succumbing to my seduction. And so there's a packaging there with rebelling against the authority and rebelling against yourself and, you know, being sold on something.
Yeah, good. But also, if you think about classically, seduction is like the man is the one seducing the woman, right? And the man is in a position of dominance over the woman. The man has like older, has more power. And there isn't any conceit of equality between them. And you might think that partly worked because of the dominance. And that once you get to the world that we live in, where it's much more equal, it's predictably what's going to happen is that the very fact of someone expressing interest in you is going to, you're going to be putting up resistance to that. Right. And that there's that once we're equal, there's always this question, is one of us a little bit ahead of the other? And then, you know, making sure we stay equal by putting up my resistance to make sure you're not dominating me. And then I seem like I'm dominating you, so you have to put up resistance. And so that equality creates this fertile breeding ground for basically revenge or counter control.
I was noticing how if you are afraid that I am trying to dominate you, I can distract you from that by saying those other people are trying to dominate you. Your parents or your current partner is trying to dominate you. I'm trying to free you from their domination.
Right. Fair enough. And so it may be that seduction strategies classically didn't just involve, hey, I'm dominant, recognize that. They involved trickery because you have to substitute yourself for the other dominant forces in my life, right? So, but still, it seems to me that there's also this, like, I do think that dating dating and romance in general is a really, like, canonical arena for this counterproductive behavior. And maybe it's true that when romance becomes more egalitarian, you're going to get more of this kind of counterproductive behavior.
I think in dating, there's also, you know, there's this conflict. Basically, if you're, say, not many people have asked you out and you're feeling unloved, and then you're basically comparing yourself to other people around you who are more loved, and they're sort of lording it over you. They've got many boyfriends, and they get many dates, and you don't. Now, that dominance, you resent their dominance, and they're lording that over you. And then if some man offers you a date, you know, that can be seen as the way that you get back at these other women who have been trying to dominate you by their higher popularity. As long as he would just not try to dominate too much, you could accept that, but that if somehow it gets framed as he's trying to dominate you, then you'll resist that. So it's often like there's multiple parties, and the question is, which one are you resisting?
Right.
So think of a soldier in the war, right? You know, you could say, I'm a private, and there's these officers over me. They keep telling me what to do, and they tell me where I have to go and what to sleep. I hate them. And then the soldiers above you, what they're trying to tell you is, the Hun and the enemy, they're trying to dominate you. They're trying to come and dominate us. That's why we are resisting them, right?
Right. Maybe this is part of why, like, a united front and an enemy is so important. Because then we all coordinate on what, you know, at least we're not trying to dominate each other.
Right. So there's this old hypothesis, which still seems very striking to me to consider. Like, if only there were aliens for us to fight, the world would just get together so much more. So could we, like, make up aliens and pretend they're there somehow, or make up the possibility that just get everybody to get together more, right?
I mean, I feel like the AI is an opportunity here. You're fighting this, but, like, a lot of people are ready to jump on Team Human against AIs. You know, it's a little hard to fight aliens that are super duper far away.
Right.
The AIs are just, you know, right inside of our computers.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, if only fighting the AI would inspire us to cooperate enough.
Yeah, might be worth
that. We might, so if say you could go to Ukraine and Russia and say, I know you've been wanting to fight this war, but, and we would usually let you continue the war, but right now we've got this AI thing to deal with. Would you please stop the war for now so we could deal with AI?
Right, exactly. That, like, it could do a lot of good, right? All the effort to coordinate on the pause would be like intertwining humanity in a web of cooperation.
So I'm thinking of say rebellions. It's striking how when I've seen many sort of, you know, documentaries or stories about rebels, that there's really a lot of hierarchy inside the rebel group. And often, like, the reason given is, look, our first priority is resisting, like, this outside power. We can't be, you know, focusing on all our own internal egalitarian squabbles here. You just need to fall in line and do what the leaders say, because the priority is we're resisting them.
Right. And it's so it's like, if you're right that this is just a very powerful motivator, then and that in particular, the only thing that beats this as a motivator is this as a motivator again against some other group.
Right.
And so we allow ourselves to be dominated by A so as to avoid being dominated by B. That'd be depressing. Because if it's true that this motive is a particularly self-defeating one, and that the only way we defeat it is by doing this again in some other arena,
right.
And we're probably not going to buy into doing it in a place where there's no cost, then it seems like all we do is like escalate, right? Like, oh, we're friends with each other, but now we're going to have this incredibly costly war against those other people. Like, our war against the aliens would probably be pretty costly.
Right.
So
I'm thinking of police reform in this context. So there's two enemies who might be trying to dominate you. There's the criminals.
Right.
You might think are trying to dominate you. And then there's the police themselves who would be dominating you.
Right.
Whichever one of those you focus on as the one you're really trying to resist domination from, then the other is your ally.
Right.
So, you know, among rich whites, it's the criminals who are the enemy who's trying to dominate you, and the police are your allies against that. Whereas in, you know, inner city blacks or whatever, they might more think, no, it's the police that's trying to dominate me here, and these other criminals are actually my allies in this war.
Yeah, maybe. I don't actually know what they say. Like, do they want more policing or less policing in their neighborhoods? I don't know the answer.
It has varied with how each one frames it.
Right. But, okay, I want to go back to Oedipus for a minute. Because the thing about, I think there's something really interesting. The sort of framing of the Oedipus story is like, there's a guy and he goes to an oracle and he finds out something incredible and he's like, that can't be right. And he tries to disprove it, but the very act of disproving it proves it true. And a really weird thing is that Plato tells the story of Socrates in exactly the same. So he says, you know, Chaerephon goes to this oracle at Delphi and says, is there anyone wiser than Socrates? And the oracle says no. And Socrates finds this out. He's like, no, that can't be true. And he devotes the rest of his life to refuting the oracle, showing that there are people wiser than him. And so he goes up to people and he's like, I bet you're wiser than me. Let me ask you some questions.
Right.
It turns out he's not wiser. He's like, and let me go to another guy and ask him, right? And so Socrates himself engages in this sort of counterproductive activity because he ends up proving that the oracle is right through his attempts to prove it wrong. But I think this is the whole point of the story. It's not a bad thing. Socrates is like, and this was great. It was awesome for me. You know, I got to be a philosopher. And every time I did this, I kind of learned more, right? So that there is this almost like, it's like there's this possibility that this very mechanism could be used for the forces of good and that's what arguing is.
That's the reverse psychology scenario, really. If you think this oracle thought, here's a nice promising young man. Let me get him to be a philosopher. How could I do that? Here's that. I'm going to tell him something he's going to want to defy, and then that'll, you know, set him off on the path.
Sure, if we think of the oracle as, you know, making some kind of a calculation there. But Socrates' response to the oracle is a kind of crazy one, if you think about it. It's like if somebody was like, suppose a really, really reliable source was like, Robin, you're the wisest guy, right? And like, most of us would be like, thanks, you know?
Right.
Secretly, I always thought maybe I was the wisest, that might have this really good confirmation.
Aw, sharks.
And yeah, exactly. And Socrates is like, I know very well that I'm not wise. So what can the god possibly mean by saying that I'm wise? But Socrates' sort of adversarial stance is not something like, I know that the oracle is wrong. Let me go and live my life in the light of its. It's like there's this kind of engagement with it or something like it. Like Oedipus doesn't ever go back to the oracle and be like, see, it worked out fine.
Right.
So it looks like there's some kind of adversarial, you know, this problem, this Oedipal problem, can be turned to the forces of good.
So, I mean, it occurs to me, feel like one must mention that in the Oedipus context and in the Socrates context, they had other strategies that were more guaranteed to work. Like, if Oedipus just don't ever kill anybody, don't ever marry anybody, that would have worked, right?
Yes.
But the same for Socrates. Like, you know, how could you prove that you're not the smartest? Just don't go around talking to people and acting smart, right?
Well, no, I mean, that wouldn't prove that you're not the smart. Like, I guess if you really wanted to, it does seem to me that if what you want to do is show that you're not the smartest, finding someone who's smarter than you that's a pretty reasonable strategy. Because you could secretly think that you're smart, right? You'd be like, yeah, deep down, I have all this wisdom.
Well, I could just cause myself not to be very smart by just not reflecting on it.
But you know, he already has all the wisdom. Like, it's too late, right? Maybe you could forget stuff. I don't know.
Right.
But his point was not to prove that in the future he wouldn't be smart. His point was to prove that the oracle was wrong about him at that last time. And I think he took the best strategy for that. But you're right about Oedipus. Oedipus did not take a great strategy. But I think that Oedipus's strategy, if you look at just the counterproductive stuff that people do, it's often really obvious that there's another thing they could have done that would have been much better. You know, just don't buy the candy bars. Don't, like, buy them and then lock them in the trunk of your car. So we are, in fact, Oedipal in this way, where we employ these complex strategies that are precisely self-undermining, where if anyone who wasn't caught in that exact battle with themselves would employ a much simpler strategy. That's part of what it is to be Oedipal.
So, I mean, related is if two people are fighting a lot, right, what you might be tempted to do is, I'm just going to prove to them they're wrong and that'll settle this. And you might think, if you just stop arguing with them, the fight would go away.
Exactly. Right. But the strategy that occurs to you from your Oedipal point of view is, I got it. One more sentence and we're going to get it. And I had this experience on Twitter. Where, you know, there was this profile of me and then there's people complaining about it. And I'm like, you know what? I think I'll just straighten everybody out. But the nice, clear Twitter thread, it's like, boy, did that not work, right? I created this monster of opposition to me that is now unified on this thing that they probably wouldn't even have been unified about before. But now it's like the main complaint against me because I stood on one side. And so I created
right.
a position.
But here's an interpretation. We'd say there's a fight going on. And what you want to do is fight while having a different reason you give yourself than fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this other thing you claim you're trying to make go away. But what you really want to do is fight. And so what we do see consistently in these cases is people like showing their strength and effort to resist, right? And they may fail at the particular goal they're claiming to try to achieve, but they are succeeding in showing that they are putting a lot of energy into it and are being defiant in a certain sense.
Right. But my thought here is, sure, we can give that analysis about, you know, a strong motive or something that we have. And then it also just seems to be true that this is just our motive and it really does motivate us. And it's not clear that anything could substitute for this strong motive. But the case of Socrates seems to suggest that it's possible to put it to productive use. And if you think about our, like, control battles, right, where you and I battle for control over the conversation, and, you know, each of us, there's some point we want to make, or we want to be like, no, I'm skeptical about that, or like that kind of fighting is productive, and it's productive even if it induces the counter-control response. That's how it's productive, is by inducing the counter-control response. And so it'll be really interesting to ask, are there other contexts, like safe spaces for control battles, right?
Right.
Where the point, Plato's point, I think, is that Socrates discovered a safe space for control battle, and so his life was awesome. Oedipus did his control battle in the not-safe space of just everyday life, and it was a complete and total disaster.
So apparently, you know, famously, a lot of very accomplished people were very competitive people.
Right.
That is, they just had the strong motive to win contests with other people around them.
Yeah, I'm very competitive.
Right. I think Bill Gates was famously very competitive as a child. And we might say, well, that's this fighting, you know, oppositional instinct going well. Maybe, you know, often the thing that will make you competitive and fight is this idea, they don't think I can win. They think
yeah.
they're going to win. They think it's obvious that they're going to win and I couldn't win. I'm going to damn prove to them that I could win.
So my experience of you is that you're not very competitive. And yet, you're sure motivated. In the relevant context, you're definitely motivated to battle for control. But
right. I can still see myself as defiant about all these, you know, authorities. And there's all these things I would be supposed to do to go along with their authority. And I don't do.
Right. Right. So it might be that in some sense, defiance is the common denominator. Like competitive people can kind of conjure that up out of nowhere or something. But if you set things up so that somebody can see the situation in terms of defiance, almost anyone's going to be like, yeah, I'm going to defy it. At the end of the day, we're all Oedipus. And we're all going to reason like Oedipus, which is terribly in the context where we're defiant.
So I wonder how much defying outside ourselves or inside ourselves is more productive. So we've talked a lot about the internal defiance, but that might be counterproductive, that it might be that we so focus on fighting ourselves inside ourselves that we can't get on to the outside.
Maybe it's just we don't have enough outside enemy, right? Like probably the outside enemies would distract us. You know, we'd become a unified front. Like probably I'm not so trying to defy myself when I'm trying to control you. Because I got to focus on, you know,
right.
Agnes has to unify, right? But then I'm sitting here by myself in my office and there's no you and there's no one to talk to. And I'm like, I really shouldn't work. I shouldn't go on Twitter. But then my other self is like, damn it, I'm going to go on Twitter. So maybe that's a big part of like why other people are important. They help us have a unified front of a self.
So in the Harry Potter stories, you know, they break the whole school into these four houses who have these conflicts with each other,
right.
Even though there's no particular need for them, right?
Right.
Just inducing conflicts. And I understand, like, famously in Greek history, there was some political theorist who basically broke the whole country into a half dozen or a dozen, like, different groups of people that were spread all over, and then the people were organized by those. But basically, there's a lot of...
In Athens?
I thought it was spread across a larger group. But anyway, basically, they just formed these new kinds of groups that were more geographically spread, and they had people identify with these groups. And, you know, it seems like we don't use that as much as we could, but like there's this possibility to just create new groups and create these rivalries that produce this defiance energy.
I think, though, that you need a structure for that to take place in. Like, with the Harry Potter school, there are like these tournaments, right? And then each house sends fighters to the tournament and they're trying to win the trophy or whatever, right? And there are points and there are
right.
Like there's a larger structure within which they're competing, and there's a way in which there is a structure that just naturally forms where you can compete without a larger, and that's like war. But it's a little bit harder if what you're trying to do is get a three-way or a four-way war going. It's like you need to be more organized.
But it just strikes me, I've been in schools that you could have divided it into four houses.
Right.
And collected points. They just never did that, right? I've been in many organizations where they just didn't take this option that the Harry Potter world did of making these four units that were then highlighted in rivalries.
I mean, I just went to a dinner at my house as an undergraduate at the University of Chicago. So it was in a dorm called Burton Judson. And
that was my dorm.
The yacht was my
dorm.
Okay. You lived in Burton Judson. And wait, you were in Coulter, weren't you?
Yes.
Okay. Notice that I remember that. And I was at Dauphine. And like, oh, you're one of the Coulter people. I'm one of the Dauphine people. So I went to this dinner, and the dinner was in Dauphine House, which is just a coincidence. They invited me. They didn't know this. When they find out that I was a Dauphineer, they were like, whoa, Dauphineer, we're the best house. And they're also like, well, which side were you on? Were you on the Daud side or the Mead side? And the Mead people are like very egalitarian about, like, they think the Daud people are fine, but the Daud people all think they're better than the Mead people. The Daud people think Daud is the best house, which I think obviously because I'm a Daud. And all of this is very Harry Potter, and this is pre-Harry Potter, right? I was, you know,
right.
Before it was written. People, and there isn't much like, competition, like there aren't official competitions or anything, but people do have this sense of like, which house do you belong to? And so you can get it set up just by like name the geographical locations.
I just notice how this is something we are doing with many other things around us. Like, we could basically take different neighborhoods and give them names and then have some like local sports contest between different neighborhoods. But we don't do that.
Right. But even just taking the neighborhoods and giving them names, we do that. And people do identify with their neighborhoods. Like, I see myself as a Hyde Parker. So, we should probably stop because we've talked for now.
All right. It's been nice talking.